Late one Sunday night in August 1853, a messenger arrived at the home of Victoria's Lieutenant Governor, Charles La Trobe. A convicted murderer called John Goldman was going to be hanged in Geelong at 8 o'clock the next morning. Information had emerged that cast doubt on the truthfulness of a key witness at Goldman's trial. The messenger carried a desperate letter from a Geelong clergyman urging La Trobe to delay Goldman's hanging and investigate. "I implore Your Excellency," he wrote, "to reprieve him." La Trobe had gone to bed, but he got up to read the letter and work out what to do. He decided that the hanging should be stopped. But in 1853, there was no railway or telegraph line between Melbourne and Geelong. The only way to get the message to the jail was for the messenger to turn round and ride back through the night, carrying La Trobe's letter of reprieve. When La Trobe consulted his advisers in the Executive Council the next day about Goldman's case, they didn't know whether the messenger had reached Geelong in time to stop the execution. They didn't know whether Goldman was alive or dead. They decided that if he hadn't been hanged, they would spare his life and commute his sentence to a jail term. If he had been hanged, that was too bad. That same day, the clergyman wrote a second letter to La Trobe, telling him what had happened. The messenger had arrived at the jail just 10 minutes before Goldman was due to be hanged. Goldman's is Victoria's most dramatic death sentence reprieve, and in Geelong at least, it's one of the better known. But behind the public announcement that a prisoner would be spared or that a hanging would go ahead, there were investigations and debates that were long kept secret. How did the government make these decisions about who to hang and whose lives to spare? Archives from the 1850s and 60s in the Public Record Office make it possible to piece together the reasons behind many of the decisions. To show how the machinery worked, I'm going to focus on two cases, two murders, and through them look at the way in which the state chose life or death for some of its citizens. I'll be saying something about how the process fitted into the way Victoria was governed, and I'll finish by returning to its human side, to the stories of people who became caught up in the system of capital punishment. The first case is Goldman's own. It's a gold rush story, and it's an example of a kind of case that often made death penalty decisions difficult. The basic facts weren't in doubt. They were even banal, if murder can be banal. But deciding whether to hang a murderer involved grading the killing on a scale. How bad was it compared with other murders? And this is where Goldman's case got difficult. John Goldman was born in Prussia around 1830. He came to Victoria as a sailor at the age of 20 and joined the Goldfields Mounted Police. In February 1852, he was stationed at Ballarat. The gold rush was less than a year old. Goldman and the other police were living in tents at the government camp. The events leading to Goldman's conviction began with a triviality. He needed some boxes to sleep on to get his bed up off the ground. A local grocer called John Adams lent him two boxes, but when Adams sent his teenage son, Edward, to get the boxes back, trouble began. Goldman wouldn't let Adams take the boxes, so Adams went to Goldman's superior, Corporal William Harvey. Harvey began to pull the boxes from under Goldman's bed. Edward Adams' statement, made the next day, tells what happened next. Goldman said, "Don't do it," three times, and then drew a pistol which was under a sieve near his bed. I cried out, "Harvey, Harvey, he's going to fire." Harvey turned round and the pistol was in Goldman's hand, cocked and presented to Harvey. Harvey rose up and looked round, and before he could do anything, Goldman fired at him. Harvey was mortally wounded, but he lived for about 24 hours. Long enough to make a dying declaration that could be used in evidence at Goldman's trial. "I raised myself up," he said, "and looked round at him and saw he had a pistol in his hand at full cock. He immediately fired at me." Harvey was also able to put a shaky signature to his will. He left what little property he had to his destitute brother, an inmate in the Benevolent Asylum in North Melbourne. As for Goldman, he fled immediately after the shooting, but he was captured the following year. His trial in Geelong in July 1853 was brief even by the standards of the day. It was one of three trials completed that day. There were only four witnesses. Goldman's defence was that the shooting was accidental. To the extent that Adams' evidence suggested otherwise, he was speaking out of malice. Adams admitted that they'd quarrelled in the past. The jury weren't persuaded. They found Goldman guilty. The judge, Redmond Barry, pronounced the mandatory death sentence with some of his trademark rhetoric. "The blood has cried aloud to heaven for vengeance," he told Goldman, "and the shedder of blood has not been allowed to evade the laws of the Almighty. If, as you say, the death of Harvey was the result of accident, the Almighty will see your innocence." Goldman had been sentenced to death, but that, of course, was not the end of the story. In law, it was the judgment of the court that provided the legal authority to hang a prisoner. But the Crown had an overriding power to reduce the punishment or even set it aside altogether, using the prerogative of mercy. And in Victoria, the standard wording of the judgment of death left it to the Crown to set the time and place of execution. I say the Crown, but in 1853, that meant the Lieutenant Governor, acting with the advice of his senior officials, meeting as the Executive Council. They met in the old government offices in William Street, where the Supreme Court is now. To anyone outside the government, this process was hidden by the oath of secrecy that members of the Executive Council had to take. But in the 1850s and 60s, the minutes of the Council reveal the deliberations behind many of its decisions about death sentences. Goldman was a policeman who'd killed a superior officer. That much of his case was bound to get a harsh reaction. On the other hand, he was relatively young, 23, and he behaved well in jail. Like many prisoners under sentence of death, he sent a petition asking for clemency. It's not in his own words. It used respectful formulas that were very different from Goldman's own writing, but it struck the right note of submission and supplication. It said Harvey's death was not premeditated. It was the result of accident. And Goldman was, as it said, a foreigner and friendless in the colony. Two outsiders participated in parts of the Executive Council meeting. The Council always received a report from the judge in capital cases, sometimes in writing, usually in person, so Redmond Barry came along. The most important question for the judge was usually whether there was any doubt about the prisoner's guilt. Barry seemed to have none in Goldman's case. The other outsider at the meeting was more unusual. A pastoralist, J.P. Rose, came in to say that he thought Goldman had stayed at his sheep station for some time, about a year before, and that Goldman had seemed to be, as Rose put it, affected in his mind. The Council often investigated signs of madness in prisoners whose cases they considered. They wouldn't hang Goldman if he was insane. But Rose's evidence didn't amount to much, and he seemed to be the only person who had these suspicions about Goldman. None of this was enough to save Goldman at the Council's first meeting. His hanging was ordered for the 15th of August. The public knew that a decision to hang a prisoner didn't always stand. If the prisoner had supporters, the announcement of an execution date spurred a lobbying campaign that became more intense as the day approached. Goldman had such advocates, led by the ministers of two churches in Geelong. Their names might have raised an irreverent smile when they tried to save someone from the noose. The first was the Reverend Andrew Love, and the second was the Reverend Theodore Stretch. Love got an impressive list of local worthies to sign a petition in Goldman's favour, including the mayor of Geelong and four other members of the town council. Other petitions were organised by a local justice of the peace and by the naturalist William Blandowski, who rallied the expatriate German community. The petitions didn't do Goldman any harm, but they didn't have much to add to the arguments that Goldman had already used, and the council had rejected those. So when the council met a second time to consider the public petitions, it reaffirmed its decision. Goldman was still to hang. What saved his life was the emergence of new information that gave these arguments more leverage. Here, Reverend Theodore Stretch enters the story. His last-minute letter to Latrobe, the day before the hanging, sent information from a local school teacher who had taught Edward Adams, the only surviving witness to the shooting. The teacher, William Behan, also wrote to Latrobe. He said he'd found Adams' conduct at school objectionable, he didn't say why, and said he'd be very scrupulous in receiving his testimony. At the same time, William Blandowski, the naturalist, wrote a second letter with his own reasons for not trusting Adams. These were out of the ordinary. Adams had been in court before. The previous year, he'd been a witness at the trial of a man called Richard Westgarth. Adams was about to turn 14 at the time. It was 4 months after he'd witnessed the shooting of Harvey. He and Westgarth had been sharing a bed in a hut on the goldfields, common practice at the time. During the night, Adams said Westgarth had tried to have sex with him. The next morning, Adams went and told someone what had happened. Westgarth was charged with attempted sodomy. At his trial, Westgarth was acquitted. There was no one to corroborate Adams' story, and Westgarth had two witnesses to show his good character. Blandowski said this verdict showed Adams hadn't been believed and was an untrustworthy witness. That's possible, but the records of the case make it equally likely that the jury gave Westgarth the benefit of the doubt without necessarily being convinced that Adams was a liar. Latrobe didn't take the information at face value. When Blandowski said the shooting of Harvey was accidental, Latrobe wrote in the margin, "Why didn't Goldman say so at the time?" And when Stretch said Goldman was convicted on the sole testimony of Adams, Latrobe scribbled another query. The court had the dying declaration of Harvey to corroborate Adams. Nevertheless, these extra grains of doubt were enough to save Goldman's life. Any doubts about the evidence at the trial undermined the counsel's confidence that Goldman had acted deliberately. A premeditated, planned killing was always the worst in their eyes. A sudden impulse in the heat of the moment was less blameworthy, and in Goldman's case, there was a faint chance that the shooting was accidental, as he claimed. At its third meeting, the council recommended commuting Goldman's sentence. He got 15 years hard labour on the roads. Like many serving long jail terms, he had to serve the first 3 years in irons. My second case is part of a different phase in Victoria's history, and it represents a second group of cases that caused problems for the Executive Council. In 1860, the height of the gold rush had passed. Now, the biggest construction projects that Victoria had yet seen were linking Melbourne to Ballarat and Bendigo by rail. One of the railway workers was a man called William Bronson. He was a timekeeper. His job was to keep checks on the workers building the track near Big Hill, not far from Bendigo, or Sandhurst as it was called then. Bronson was 27. He'd been married just 6 months. Like most of the railway workers, Bronson lived in a tent near the line. The area is a mix of farms and lifestyle blocks today, but you have to imagine it as both a construction site and a temporary home for the hundreds of people building the line. On the night of the 21st of February, 1860, Bronson and his wife were in their tent when they heard noises outside. William went to investigate. His wife immediately heard gunshots. She rushed out and found to her horror that her husband had been shot and killed. "She looked about," she said, "to see if I could see anybody. There was nobody in view. I then raised a fearful cry of murder over and over again. No one came to me." The murderer had got clean away, but suspicion quickly fell on George Nile, a 30-year-old Irishman who was working for the railway builders as a carter. Nile had fallen out with Bronson, who owed him money, and when police asked what he'd been doing at the time of the murder, his answers were vague and contradictory. But beyond that, there was next to nothing to link him to the scene of the crime. The police were about to let him go when they took the precaution of unloading the small armoury of guns that they'd found in Nile's tent. In two revolvers Nile owned, the police found pieces of newspaper that had been used as wadding to hold the gunpowder and bullets in place. They'd found the clue they needed. After days spent piecing the fragments together and searching newspaper archives, they found that the wadding from Nile's revolvers came from the same newspaper articles as fragments of newspaper found at the scene of the crime, where they'd evidently been fired from the gun used to kill Bronson. What was more, a torn piece of paper from one of Nile's revolvers joined up exactly with a torn piece found under Bronson's body by the doctor who examined it at the scene. Nile was rearrested and put on trial. The pieces of newspaper were the strongest evidence against him. That sort of technical evidence might seem futuristic for 1860, but as Judith Flanders has said, identification of a murderer by gun wadding had a long pedigree in literature. The solution of a murder by matching up fragments of paper wadding had already figured in novels by Elizabeth Gaskell and Charles Dickens. But juries were sceptical. Maybe they weren't novel readers. Maybe they were, but thought fiction didn't belong in the courtroom. For whatever reasons, they were hard to convince. At Nile's first trial, the jury couldn't agree. At a second trial, the jury found him guilty, but recommended mercy, as they put it, on the ground of the evidence being circumstantial. "In our own consciences," they added, "we feel him guilty." The doubts about the evidence were about to get a lot worse. 2 days after Nile was convicted, a Bendigo man called George Jackson signed a statement contradicting the police evidence about the newspaper fragments. He had helped a policeman take the wadding out of Nile's guns, he said, but it was plain paper, not newspaper, and the policeman had boasted about the money he could get by making a good job of it, presumably from a reward. This was the situation that confronted the governor, Sir Henry Barclay, and the executive council when they met to consider Nile's case. In Goldman's case, there was no doubt that he had killed a man. The problem was assessing how blameworthy the killing was. Nile's case represents a different group of capital cases, where the main question was whether the police got the right person in the first place. The governor and the council could make up their own minds about that question, independently of the jury's verdict. They saw that the newspaper fragments were the key to Nile's conviction, so they got them out, along with a powerful magnifying glass, and looked for themselves to see if the pieces matched. They decided that they did. And the trial judge, in his report to the council, said he thought Nile was guilty. As for Jackson's statement, confidential reports from the police cast doubt on what he'd said. The dates in his statement didn't seem to make sense. And even if the statement was true, it didn't explain how the paper produced by the police matched the fragments found by the doctor under Bronson's body. The police had no opportunity to put them there. So the council unanimously advised Barclay that the death sentence should be carried out. He agreed. Barclay signed Nile's death warrant. It's still in the public record office. It ordered the sheriff of the Supreme Court to carry out the sentence on the 10th of September. This news caused a storm of protest in Bendigo. A public meeting said to have been attended by 1,500 people resulted in a telegram to the Premier expressing what it called utmost astonishment that Niall's execution had been ordered without what it called necessary and promised inquiry. Jackson himself turned up at the meeting and reaffirmed his statement, adding amidst extraordinary sensation, the telegram said, that he had not been communicated with by government. The thought that the government hadn't even talked to Jackson was especially infuriating. In the face of this barrage, the governor ordered a week-long reprieve for Niall to allow time to investigate. He was also concerned about the way the council was handling the case. For ministers to peer at the evidence through a magnifying glass, like Sherlock Holmes ahead of his time, raised serious questions about procedure. The council operated in secret. Prisoners and their lawyers usually had no idea what new information the council was looking at, and no chance to ask questions. These concerns led the council to do something unusual in Niall's case. It asked the Attorney General and the Solicitor General to investigate Jackson's statement, but in the presence of Niall's barrister and with the government shorthand writer there to record the evidence. The inquiry went ahead and took 3 days of testimony, but the results were inconclusive. Jackson and the police stuck to their stories. When the council met for the third time to discuss Niall's case, they had the evidence from the inquiry, the evidence from the trial, and a petition from 8 members of the jury saying that they would not have found Niall guilty if they'd known about Jackson's statement. After a long discussion of what they called the intricacies of evidence with which the whole case is surrounded, the council reached the conclusion that the evidence wasn't strong enough for Niall to be hanged. His sentence was commuted to life in prison with hard labour. Like Goldman, Niall had to spend the first 3 years in irons. The Argus newspaper was not impressed. The commutation of Niall's punishment, it said, is a palpable absurdity. It is acknowledging that, in the opinion of His Excellency's legal advisers, the man might have been acquitted, and this opinion procures him the boon of a lifelong imprisonment instead of death. There were prisoners who said that a life sentence was worse than hanging. The Argus said that there should have been a new trial, but that was something the governor couldn't order. And in fairness to the council, they didn't actually conclude that Niall might have been acquitted. They just weren't sure enough of his guilt to hang him. The council operated on the unstated principle that hanging required a higher standard of proof than a guilty verdict did. To order an execution, they had to be more confident of guilt than the jury needed to be. Niall's own jury made the same assumption when they found him guilty but recommended mercy because the evidence was circumstantial. The jury's recommendation might not have been entirely logical. The Bendigo Advertiser pointed out that doubts about the evidence should have influenced the verdict rather than the penalty. But the jury, like the Executive Council, operated on what was effectively an extra-legal principle, that if there was conceivable doubt about guilt, the punishment should be imprisonment instead of death. I'll return to Niall in a moment, but there's something to be said here about how the Executive Council worked. Not many people have heard of the Executive Council, but it was central to the way Victoria was governed, still is. The council's role arose from 2 basic facts. The people who ran Victoria were ministers and the parliament, but many of the powers of the government belonged in law to the governor rather than ministers. The executive council became the place where ministers told the governor how to exercise those powers. The instructions were respectfully couched as advice. The council didn't debate most of the hundreds of decisions that flooded through its agendas, but the death penalty was different. Instead of reaching a conclusion privately in cabinet and then presenting a united front to the governor, as they usually did, ministers argued out death penalty cases in the Executive Council and voted there on the outcome. And even then, the final decision about Nile was a personal responsibility of the governor. In four cases in 1861 and 62, the governor overrode the majority of the council and commuted death sentences against their advice. That action would usually make the government resign in protest, but here again, death sentences were different. The governor had instructions from the British government that gave him that right. Far from making the government resign, the governor's decisions remained secret and soon faded from institutional memory, even within the government. People characterised the Executive Council in varying ways when it made decisions about death sentences. Sometimes they described it as a court of appeal. That's what the Argus said, looking back in 1892, when the system was about to change. If it was a court of appeal, that had more significance than you might think. Until 1914, people convicted of murder and other indictable offences had no right of appeal, except theoretically, to the Privy Council in London, and it was reluctant to get involved. The trial judge could refer doubtful questions of law to the full Supreme Court, but if that didn't happen, the most that prisoners could usually do was to appeal to the government and hope for the best. There were many complaints about this state of affairs. Disappointed litigants in civil cases could appeal. People convicted of minor offences could appeal. The Bendigo Advertiser hammered home the obvious criticism. Only when human life is at stake, it said, there is no appeal. A variation on the Court of Appeal idea was that investigation by the Executive Council amounted to a second trial. Some found this idea reassuring. As the Ballarat Star put it in 1865, no man is hung who has not been, to all intents and purposes, tried twice. That is, once by the court, once by the council. If it was a trial, it was a very strange one. The council wasn't bound by rules of evidence. In capital cases, it had hardly any rules at all. One long-serving Attorney General, George Kerford, said the council was bound by no rules. Its sole desire, he said, was to get at the truth. On another occasion, Kerford said that what the council did amounted to a retrial before a grand jury. His terminology wasn't very precise. Grand juries didn't try defendants. And what was more, the notion that the council might hold a second trial and set a conviction aside touched a very sore point for some of the judges. The Attorney General of Tasmania, Charles Bromby, once rashly described the governor as acting in some measure as a court of appeal. The judges of the Tasmanian Supreme Court, led by their quarrelsome Chief Justice, Sir Francis Smith, were outraged. Smith was himself a former Attorney General and Premier, but that didn't soften his feelings. In a blistering memorandum to the governor, the judges listed the differences between the council and the courts, and incidentally showed how bad the council looked when it was measured against ideas of due process. It would indeed be anomalous, the judges said, if a few gentlemen, not necessarily possessing any legal knowledge or training, proceeding by no fixed rules, bound by no precedents, powerless to compel the attendance of a single witness, unable to administer an oath to any witness who might voluntarily attend, under no obligation to give any reason for their conclusions, and sitting in secret with closed doors, should be entrusted with the high and responsible function of reversing the judgment of the Queen's Court for her people in this island. Governor and ministers promptly disavowed any claim to act as a court of appeal, but the quarrel rumbled on for months. In Victoria, meeting from 1862 at the new Treasury building in Spring Street, the Executive Council worked in different ways in response to different cases. Sometimes jury, amateur detective, court of appeal, moral guardian, or public protector. Often, its role was to look for mitigating circumstances that the court couldn't take into account. In murder cases, the judge had no choice in sentencing. Death was the only sentence. The governor did have a choice. The executive council could consider the sort of things that a judge would have taken into account if a range of sentences was available. At other times, the council went much further. In cases like Niles, where the prisoner's guilt was in doubt, the council effectively sat as a jury on a case presented by the Attorney General and the police. When the governor and the council decided that there wasn't enough evidence to convict a prisoner, they could let them off altogether. They gave free pardons to six people who'd been sentenced to death, letting them walk free. In two other cases, they granted free pardons on legal grounds when errors of law emerged in the convictions. Punctilious lawyers observed that a pardon was not the same as setting a conviction aside. In principle, the judgment of the court stood, only the punishment was removed. But the effect was similar. In those cases, the investigation by the council was a bit like an appeal on a question of law, except that the members were not judges. Those cases were exceptional, but there was a common theme in all the cases. It was that the council ranked the crimes on two scales, one of degrees of proof and the other of degrees of criminality. Some crimes were worse than others. Some crimes were more clearly proven than others. Certain proof of a brutal crime was likely to lead to execution. Place the crime lower on either scale and a commutation became more likely. Besides these core questions, other considerations sometimes figured, sometimes not, varying from one case to another. Deterrence, protection of the public, lobbying and political pressure, and the need for consistency, although when examined this closely, most crimes began to look unique. The last thing to say about the way the process worked is to ask who had the real power. In 1860, when Nile was convicted, decisions on death sentences were made by ministers and governor collectively. The indications are that cabinet didn't discuss death sentences ahead of executive council meetings. The last time the Victorian governor vetoed majority advice on a death sentence was in 1862. That same year, the first sign emerges that ministers discussed a case in cabinet before they met the governor. But there's some reason for thinking that right up until 1892, when the system changed, the final decision on a death sentence was not made until the executive council met. It was meetings of the council, not the cabinet, that trial judges came to report on the cases. Until 1892, some decisions were influenced by what happened in the council meeting, when ministers looked at new evidence, for instance. And they continued to disagree with each other in the executive council about death sentences, something they almost never did there in other cases. The shift of authority to cabinet was confirmed by a change in the royal instructions to the governor in 1892. From then on, it was cabinet, not the council, that heard from the trial judge and looked at new evidence. It was that system that operated until the death penalty was abolished in 1975. But I want to return to the people who experienced the system for themselves. What did it mean to someone to be sentenced to death and have their life spared? What was their life like? What happened afterwards? George Nile began his life sentence in September 1860. He spent the first few years living under the separate system, in silence and isolation, forced to wear a hood whenever he left his cell. He kept his spirits up at least some of the time. He was reprimanded for whistling and dancing. They were against the rules, along with singing, talking, and even using his own name instead of his prison number. In letters from prison, he tried to get his case reviewed, saying that the police had concocted the evidence against him, but he got nowhere. When he was finally released after 20 years, he wrote to the Premier. "Mine was considered the doubtful case amongst the life prisoners," he said. "I must venture to send you my heartfelt thanks, together with those of the other prisoners whose life sentences have been commuted through your kindness and liberality in the face of much difficulty. Some in the Conservative camp have been so cruel as to assert that it would make very little difference if we were scuttled in Hobson's Bay. I admit the truth of this, but it was a sign that there was no mercy to be expected from that quarter. Heaven grant that those who have shown such cruelty have themselves a clean defaulter sheet." With that last flourish, he disappears. Where he went and what he did are unknown. We know more about John Goldman. The man Goldman killed, William Harvey, was buried in an unmarked grave, probably at Buninyong, but his memorial is elsewhere. Because he died in the course of his police duties, he's named on the police memorial in Melbourne and on the National Police Memorial in Canberra. Goldman, thanks to his last-minute reprieve, lived on. When he was under sentence of death, the petition written for him asked the governor to spare his life and thus, as the petition put it, give him an opportunity by a life of penitence to make some atonement for his crime. It was, and was meant to be, an appealing idea, but it's not quite how things turned out. Goldman spent the first few years of his 15-year sentence on the prison hulks at Williamstown. He tried to escape by swimming away, but didn't get far. In 1861, he got a conditional pardon, conditional on leaving Victoria. He was going to work his way back to Europe as a crew member. He arrived in Victoria as a sailor, after all. But the ship he sailed on caught fire at Port Phillip Heads and sank. An inquiry followed. The evidence Goldman gave was so suspicious that some were convinced he lit the fire, although he was never charged. He got a ticket of leave, a kind of parole, and poured out his sorrows in a petition to the Premier. "I know nothing about the burning of the ship," he said. He lost everything he owned in the fire. "I cannot get employment no place," he said. "I shot my fellow officer by accident and not willfully. I have suffered more for one accident than some have done for a willful murder. I'm compelled to sleep out in the straw with no bedding, just like a wild beast." Superintendent Nicholson of the police wasn't impressed. "I'm satisfied that he is at least a little crazy," he said, "and of a sullen, brooding, vindictive disposition." Goldman was released in 1865. Out of jail, he was no longer John Goldman, murderer, but became John Lorenzky, plasterer and boarding house keeper. You'd think being sentenced to death might give someone a dislike of courts, but not the newly minted John Lorenzky. Over the next 20 years, he was constantly in the courts in Melbourne and in Sydney, charged with a crime, charging someone else with a crime, suing or being sued, usually as a result of losing his temper and lashing out. He married, but he and his wife soon separated. In 1869, a letter he wrote threatening his wife and stepson landed him in court again. He was bound over to keep the peace, always a challenge for him. He later remarried, and the old sailor ended his days back on the water as a fisherman at St Kilda. At the age of 73, he found himself stranded in his fishing boat out in the bay, unable to bring it back to shore. Stubborn as ever, he refused to be rescued until finally a customs launch towed him in. He died in 1913 at the age of 83, survived by his second wife. They're buried together in an unmarked grave in the Springvale Cemetery. What about the people who decided who to hang and who to spare? In a different era, California Governor Pat Brown wrote about the clemency decisions he made in the 1960s. It was an awesome, ultimate power over the lives of others that no person or government should have or crave, he said. And looking back over their names and files now, despite the horrible crimes and the catalogue of human weaknesses they comprise, I realise that each decision took something out of me that nothing, not family or work or hope for the future, has ever been able to replace. But Brown was writing in the light of a century and more of arguments for the abolition of capital punishment, a goal that he himself came to support. And his own exercise of the power of clemency had been controversial. It's unlikely that Victoria's colonial politicians or governors would have thought in the same way. Yet there are traces that suggest they too found the decisions weighed on them. There were occasional protests by ministers against decisions to carry out death sentences, but also dissents insisting that a prisoner should be hanged. Governor Barclay said that it was always more agreeable to his feelings to be advised to commute a capital sentence. The last governor, who, in theory at least, had a personal discretion in decisions on the death penalty, was the Earl of Hopetoun. In his private papers, there's a drawing of the notorious murderer, Frederick Deeming, one of the last prisoners whose sentence Hopetoun confirmed. It shows Deeming's corpse hanging from the noose after his execution. It's a strange and violent image for the mild-mannered Hopetoun to keep. He didn't say what he thought about the picture or why he kept it, but we do know he was relieved when responsibility for confirming death sentences passed officially to Cabinet in 1892. It's been 47 years since the last execution was recorded in the register of death sentences kept in the Executive Council office. The machinery of capital punishment is rapidly fading from legal memory. Its historical record, like Hopetoun's drawing, is a confronting reminder of what it means for the law to exact the ultimate penalty.